Hi, folks. RJ here. Just wanted to drop in and make a couple notes before the latest episode. Yes, of Entirely the Right Sort of Podcast. Nice and long one today. About Trappist, which I actually recorded quite a few months ago with my friend John. John has his own podcast called Two Geek Soup. And listeners of Page of the Wind will know him as John from Ventus. And he's actually one of the hosts of the little Page of the Wind interlude that I, John, and five others are doing for the Narrow Road Between Desires. So you can check that out over on the Page of the Wind feed if you are a fan. But as the year draws to a close, I know I have not really put out much content at all this year. So thank you all for your continued support. For those listeners who have just found this podcast, who are trickling in, hi, happy to have you. Hope you like it and looking forward to getting into some more characters and some more discussion. So as I said, today's episode with Trappist, John and I think actually recorded in February, and it is making its appearance now. I have in mind, it's not snowy here, but I have in mind Snowy Tarbian and Kvothe's interactions with Trappist, interactions with Encanis on Midwinter. And also just wanted to note, it's Christmas Eve. I celebrate Christmas. So Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays to everybody. If you celebrated Hanukkah, if you celebrate other holidays, if you're looking forward to the 2024 New Year or the Lunar New Year, Year of the Rabbit, if you celebrated Diwali, Winter Solstice, any of that. Trappist, John and I also talked about religion and Temerant. He and I both have a personal and an academic history with religion and with the Bible. So our lens is mostly coming from our backgrounds in Christianity. Those are some of the kind of references and comparisons we are going to make, because that is how we grew up. And we'll make other references as well throughout, but I just wanted to say that, hopefully our discussion is accessible to those folks who, did not go to school to study the Bible and Christianity. So we hope that you enjoy this perspective, and wish you all a Merry Christmas, Happy 2024, and we'll see you down the road. Thanks. Hello, hello, and welcome once again to another exciting, delicious episode of Entirely the Right Sort of Podcast, where we talk about King Killer Chronicle characters one by one. I sometimes two at a time. Welcome back. It's been a little while since we've had our last episode. My name is RJ. I'm your host, and that stands for Religious Justiciar, which is sort of topical for today. And I am joined by a friend of mine, fellow Name of the Wind, Wise Man's Fear enthusiast, and member of my D&D group, and friends of Page of the Wind might recognize him. Who are you and what are you doing here?
I am John Vinalas, in Name of the Wind, or Page of the Wind parlance. I am known as John from Ventus, your humble. Nick once called me a religious scholar, which is definitely overselling it a bit. I'm a lay theologian at best.
Only a bit.
But yeah, we're here to talk about Trappist.
We are. And John approached me and asked if I wanted to do this, and I'm excited. So he and I both have backgrounds kind of in studying religion. So Trappist is an exciting character, and I like thinking about the religions of Temerant. And John and I have had some exciting discussions off mic, and we're just ready to bring them on about Trappist and how we can... what we can learn from his character, but also how the Talon religion compares a bit to ones we know in this world, right?
For sure.
So before we just start diving in, We have prepared 7 facts, as is traditional. I don't think Ari ever brought Quoth 7 things. That would be a lot. They usually stick to 3.
Given him several things, but like the most important, like it drives me nuts. We're gonna probably be full of little rabbit trails here, but like it does drive me nuts how little he pays attention to the things that he gives her, or at least how little he tells us about the things that she gives him. Because they're obviously super important, because it's a key, a coin, and a candle, just like what's his name? The
just like
Tamburlaine the Great. Yes, that's what I was looking for.
Right. But I was saying she's never given him like 7 things
at once. No, not at once, no.
But we are going to give all of you 7 things at once about Travis. So I'll go ahead and start. The first thing is that he tries to live under the radar without too much money, and he kind of relies on, seems like, partnerships with the kids he helps sometimes, but also maybe with some like-minded people in Tarbian.
Yeah. Something else that the text tells us about him is that he has bad feet, that he's in daily pain. Constant pain from his bad feet. It's poor circulation, and maybe he's diabetic. We don't really know. I don't know if they have a word for that, but that's something that is brought out a few times.
That's a good point. I thought, diabetes, that could be it. I thought maybe they were just like hurt for, or like had, I don't know, had a fungal infection from just being like cold and wet.
Oh, that's time, totally possible. Maybe? Yeah.
That they were just like gross.
See, I didn't get gross from the description. I just got like that they were painful to him, but
that they probably give him pain. Yeah. Number 3 about Trappas is that he cares for sick and starving children. It seems like mostly boys, and especially disabled kids and kids who can't help themselves and maybe would hurt themselves.
Mm-hmm. He is himself very poor. You know, you mentioned that he doesn't do with a lot of money, or he doesn't use a lot of money in the work that he's doing, but it says that Quoth mentions that he only ever sees him wearing the same, you know, dirty robe. And even when he comes back years later, when he visits him in Tarbian after coming back from Severin, he says he's still wearing that same old robe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is. And he also doesn't take a lot of money either. I think that kind of shows his kind of street smarts too.
Yeah, definitely.
Living. And then number 5 is that just kind of some location. We don't have a lot of facts about him, so I threw this on there. Number 5 is that he lives in the basement of a burned out building. So I guess in Tarbian, there's not a whole lot of building codes to where if something burns down, you gotta raise it and then, you know, make a new coffee shop. Right. So they're probably safe under there for a little while.
Yeah. Okay. So number 6 is that Trappas gives us the story of Taelu and Incanus, which is super cool. As anyone who is paying attention in these books knows, like stories, anytime someone is telling a story, that's super important and we need to pay close attention to it. And, you know, we sort of think, you know, it's the only story that Quoth ever hears him tell. He sort of struggles to come up with a story that he knows when one of his kids is asking for a story, and this is the thing that he comes up with. Maybe it's the only story that he really knows, slash, maybe it's the only story that he's really interested in telling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. He might not really want to talk about anything else that he remembers. And then the 7th fact we had is that Trappist remembers Quoth, even, you know, in the first years, the first time Quoth takes a damn bath and gets those clothes, Trappist recognizes him and is like, hey, man, go get some water. And then 3 years later, when he comes back, Trappist recognizes him too, but the other children do not.
Right.
Right. They see his clean, you know, they see his clothes and his state, you know, as his worth and his class. And Trappist just, you know, would help anybody. Yeah. So, man, what a guy. So why did you want to come on and talk about Trappist? Why is he a compelling character to you, John?
The thing that I was really interested in doing, Trappist is sort of a pretext to just sort of talk about religion and Temerant in general, because I think we have a lot of really cool things going on there. And of course, primarily, you know, I love to see the parallels that are brought out between the Telin religion and Christianity. But of course there's a rich, you know, so there's a whole world's worth of religion. And of course, the Telin religion is the one that we get the most of because it's what is most, widely practiced in Temerant, or in the corner of Temerant that we really see. But we get little mentions and hints of all sorts of other things. You know, Willem talks about how stodgy and like, or not stodgy, but how, he feels as though, the monotheism of Telinism is like very quaint. and that makes me interested in what do the Shald, what sort of religion do the Shaldish have that they feel is so much more enlightened than a monotheism, because when you actually look at the
when he makes that,
I don't remember
when does he make that comment.
It's at some point during Name of the Wind. I don't exactly remember because I didn't look it up. All
right.
Because it just sort of came to me right now, but but it's kind of an interesting assertion to make, because if you actually look at the development of religion in like a historical and like sociological sense, like monotheism tends to be like a development, you know, you sort of start with animism, like this idea that like everything has a spirit, you know, and that tends to develop into a pantheon of gods that you know each have dominion over certain aspects of nature, and then that only, you know, sort of tends to then develop into like monotheism. And of course we only have like three main, you know, monotheistic religions in our world, but like these all sort of arise and are like codified as like monotheistic faiths, like out of this context of the idea of like many gods. So
And I just thinking now, I wonder what, if any, religion they have in Edemrae.
Well, see,
because I don't think
you don't, because the Lithani, the Lithani is the thing that they practice, right? That's functionally
right, of
what the religion is, and it would sort of be akin to like a Zen Buddhism,
I guess
is what I would say.
And they do have, I guess, they do have revered figures in Aetha and Raetha who, you know, were the the first student and teacher with the arrow story.
Well, and that's like Buddhism a little bit as well because, of course, the Buddhists don't have a god, you know, figure per se.
But they do have the former prince himself. This is gonna be a good one. I feel like we both are gonna have our academic hats on. I just want to make sure we give Trappist some appreciation.
For sure.
And also mention, you know, here's something I want to I'm just kind of bringing together now for the first time, John. Because when I was looking, literally as we're getting ready for this, I'm kind of looking through those early chapters, those Tarpeian mm-hmm. chapters. There's a lot of mention of Teilu. There's the whole midwinter thing. There's Teilu, and then, you know, there's Kvothe thinking of the angels, right? There's like angel imagery. Is it when he's really like sick? And then you get Scarpy's story about mm-hmm. the angels. Like, it's all really, you get so much like foundational religious myth and world myth in Tarpeian. Like, it really is like a, you almost like, I guess like Kvothe, right? Kvothe is so traumatized by his parents' death and then by everything that happens to him in Tarpeian that nothing, you know, really wakes him up until he, you know, hears a story about Lanrean and the Chandrian. But it's almost like we're in that, you know, the first couple times we read it, maybe we're in that with him. Like, we're just focused on his story and we don't necessarily see like how big this stuff is.
You know, but I've like, said,
when you start talking about the angels and shit, man, it's crazy.
I've mentioned in a letter to Page of the Wind before that, like, I'm endlessly amused at how the training that I have in studying the Bible has stood mm-hmm. Stood me in good stead reading these books, because like no other book that I've ever read apart from the Bible, like, Kingkiller very much rewards careful, repeated reading. And there are things, mm-hmm. there are things going on in the way that Pat has written these books that when you're someone who has a little bit of hermeneutics under their belt, that hermeneutics is an approach. It's an approach that you take to interpreting a text. So it's your interpretive framework for interpreting a text or for engaging with a text.
Great.
And so when you're someone who's kind of clued into this stuff and you know to look for, when you know to look for repetition, you know, when you know to look for mm-hmm, mm-hmm. for things that are out of the ordinary and that intentionally subvert your expectations. For example, you know, you're mentioning the religious imagery that we see in Tarpeian when Ancanus is the one who comes to save Kvothe in his distress on that midwinter. Like, that is, to me, that's such a huge clue. That's like that's a great big flashing sign that should be telling us, like, mm-hmm. the things that you are expecting and the way that you have been mm-hmm. trained by other stories to expect things to go, like, this is not that kind of story. And there's a lot more on here than is going to be obvious to an uncareful reader or like a first time reader. Cause like you literally cannot understand a lot of what's going on in these books until you have read both of them at least once through. And then come back for a second or third or fourth or 18th run. And like, it's the reason why it can sustain a podcast like Page of the Wind, where you can talk about every single page at length.
At length, length, length. And so I was just on their Women's Day Month episode, and I knew that a woman was with Incanus on the night that Incanus saved Quoth in the snow, but I forgot her name. And I'm kicking myself because do you know what her name is?
Oh my gosh.
Here's the
okay, hold on.
What protects you from demons? What would you not expect to be with the demon? What protects you from demons? According to the Fae.
Holly.
Subject of a story. Holly.
Her name is Holly?
The girl's name is Holly.
Oh, that's so awesome.
And the guy's name is it's Garrick, which I don't think that's Gerrek or something. I don't care about that.
But the fact that her name is Holly, that's amazing.
And man, is the picture by Dan Dos Santos, Dan Dos Santos, probably, in The Name of the Wind, 10th anniversary edition. Isn't that gorgeous?
What page is it on, RJ?
I'll find it.
Through my copy right now.
157. Yeah, 157. Yeah, and that's, while we're talking about the angel imagery, readers, this one, we're having fun. It's not necessarily super organized, but do you expect me to be? So this is after, this is when Quoth goes waterside, right? Yep. No, wait. Quoth goes, what's the nice place?
Hillside.
So Quoth comes back into waterside and he goes back to his secret place. I closed my eyes. I remember the deep silence of the deserted street around me. I was too numb and tired to be properly afraid. In my delirium, I imagined death in the form of a great bird with wings of fire and shadow. It hovered above, watching patiently, waiting for me. I slept, and the great bird settled its burning wings around me. I imagined a delicious warmth. Then its claws were in me, tearing me open, and that's when they're rolling him over. But wings of fire and shadow is what the angels are said to have in Scarpy's story, right? Or wings of shadow and blood.
It talks about wings of various kinds.
Wings of fire and shadow.
There's
wings
glass and stone and all kinds of crazy things.
And is there another time in Tarbian where I mean, okay, so certainly if you're talking about angels or, you know, other, whatever the other otherworldly things are, and don't forget, and we have to talk about who Aleph is in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah.
Too. Please, let's not forget that, because it's like, according to Scarpy's story, Aleph is above Teilu, but according to... I think, but in Trappist's story, I don't think there's a mention of Aleph.
There's not.
It's just Teilu is God and Menda, you know, is his son.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's part of why Scarpy gets arrested, is because he's saying that Aleph, you know, whoever this is greater than Teilu. And I don't think it's really a Father, Son, Holy Spirit kind of thing. I think it's...
Yeah, no, it's not. You obviously have varying and contradictory stories of what the great powers of the spiritual world of Temerant are about, you know. And at the very beginning, well, not the very, very beginning, but when Quoth starts to tell his story to Chronicler, he mentions Aleph as well.
Yeah, he does. Aleph spun the world out of, but, and I'm right here on in the 10th anniversary, page 164, Trappist's story says, now Teilu, who made the world and who is Lord over all, watch the world of men. He says made the world. He doesn't say the universe.
Okay.
Maybe it's like Teilu is the world's god and Aleph is the universe's. Whoa!
Yeah, some sort of semi-Gnostic kind of situation there.
Well, maybe it's like humans versus Fae. You know, maybe Teilu is the god of humans. I don't know.
Yeah, we're getting into total speculation now.
I love speculation. So
just one thing that I want to mention real quick, since we mentioned Scarpy's story, it talks about this group called the Ruach.
Yeah, the Ruach.
And Ruach is from Hebrew, which means watcher.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Ruach means, so who do you think the Ruach are?
Well, it looks, I mean, from the...
Like a people?
From the story of so they're with Seletos. Mm-hmm. So it does look like they are a group of people. So that's what I was just about to say. Maybe this is where the Amir comes from, and it actually does say that. Will be called the Amir in memory of the ruined city of Mir Tirinil. But anyway, sorry, that was just sort of a little aside there.
No, I'm glad you brought it up. So I believe, yes, and we were talking earlier about when Quoth gets beat by the guard on Midwinter. It is that day after that he falls down the stairs in Trappist's basement with his injuries and his fever, and we hear about Teilu and Incanus. And I wanted to, before we kind of get into the meat and potatoes of, that's a little funny because we're recording this and it's St. Patrick's Day tomorrow. God knows when this episode will come out, but meat and potatoes is funny. I wanted to contextualize for the listeners, John and I's kind of background in, you know, stuff we've studied, and particularly for John, you guys know all about me if you listen to this podcast, but I wanted to, will you please go ahead and kind of contextualize why this is so interesting to you, what countries you have lived in, what you have done, all that kind of stuff.
Sure. All right. So quick bio for me. So I was born in Columbus, Ohio, and lived there until I was 13. And then my family moved to the country of Estonia in northeastern Europe to do missionary work. I was raised in an independent Bible church, which is code for Baptist, that isn't associated with a distinct denomination, but they would definitely, some people say it's Baptist with the serial numbers filed off. So it's just sort of your basic, evangelical kind of thing where, we have what we would call a high view of scripture, which means we would say the Bible is, inerrant and inspired, I've on kind of a journey where a lot of that stuff has kind of become a little bit moderated, at least. But that was sort of growing up. It was very much like, you know, young earth creationism and, definitely taking the Bible in a very literal way, and not really being careful about examining the genre of the biblical literature that we were looking at. Most people were savvy enough at least to say that, like, oh, you know, the stuff in Psalms that's like literal poetry, that like you can't look at it and not know that it's poetry. Like, we don't have to take that stuff literally. But everything else, like, you should take as, you should just like read it, and whatever it says in like the plain English reading of it is what it means.
Sure.
And so it was not, it was frequently not an especially sophisticated hermeneutic, to go back to that term, we used before. And so anyway, but we went to then we went to Estonia, and we got involved just in a local church there, also a Baptist church. And then after graduating from high school, we all came back to the States for a year, and I started college at Cedarville University, which is a little Christian school. If you draw a triangle between Columbus and Cincinnati and Dayton, pretty much that whole area is a giant cornfield.
Mm-hmm.
And smack dab in the middle of that cornfield is a little town of 3,000 people and 3,000 students called Cedarville. And it's a Christian school. And one of the things that they do there is that every student there also receives a Bible minor. So I learned a lot about the Bible at Cedarville.
Oh, cool.
And that's where a lot of my, you know, Bible study, you know, kind of training really comes from.
I didn't know you could minor in Bible.
Yeah. Yep. At places like Cedarville, you sure can. And in fact, you're required to. But yeah, that's where I started to really, you know, get the tools to dig into the Bible a little bit more. And, you know, over the last 10 years or so, my faith journey has really been one of, looking at all of the things that I was given and sort of examining them anew. Mm-hmm. and finding out like what are really the non-negotiables and what are the things that I can hold loosely.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've found is that in holding a lot of the tangential stuff more loosely, it actually lets me hold on to the core that much more tightly. And so not, you know, because the thing that evangelical people are always, not always, frequently concerned about is like, oh, you know, if you give an inch on any of these things, it's just going to be the downfall of your faith, you know. Mm-hmm. And people who are really serious about, like, you know, like young earth creationism, like the standard line is that, like, because it's the creation story is at the beginning of the Bible. And so they'll say, oh, you know, if you don't take the first part of the Bible seriously, why would you take any other part of the Bible seriously? You know?
Yeah.
And for me, it's been a journey of seeing that, like, I think that taking the Bible seriously means reading it as it was intended to be read, mm-hmm, by the original audience, and not overlaying all of my 21st century American assumptions over top of it and just saying, well, when I read the Bible in English as an American in 2023, like, I should be able to discern immediately exactly what this means, and realizing that's just very... That's a very, very foolish way to approach an ancient text like the Bible.
Hmm.
So sure. All of that and is it, a very it... long way to say that I'm interested in this story because of how the story of Tailu and Incanus that Trappist tells, because of how fascinating the parallels between Menda and Jesus are.
Mm-hmm. And thank you. So much for sharing that, John. Listeners, John and I really only recently found out that we are from the same state. And I didn't know really until now that he had lived in Columbus. I spent some time there. And as we're talking about creationism, there is a creation museum in Kentucky, yes, that if I'm going to the airport from my mom and dad's house, the Cincinnati airport, I have to go through both Kentucky and Indiana from a different place in Ohio. That's have to too go. Funny. Sorry, because the Cincinnati airport's in Kentucky. So my parents live just in the right part of the suburbs that you got to go through Indiana to get to Kentucky, and then you got to come back to Ohio. And that's, I go past that damn creation museum because it's in that little loop.
Yeah.
But, And listeners, I'm not Catholic anymore, but I did go to Catholic school for 12 years of my life. I was a Catholic school kid, wore the, you know, the little uniform and everything. My school was co-ed, both boys and girls, the whole time. And then when I got to undergrad, I really couldn't imagine. I'd really started to think of religion more critically and more comparatively, kind of my junior and senior year, because it's like I spent so much time with Catholic doctrine, learning it, talking about it, dissecting it, that I was like, is this real? I don't really know about this. I was like, I don't really know if you need to do all this stuff and if the bread and wine really is Jesus' body and blood, or, you know, and I don't like that women can't do stuff. So I went ahead and switched, but a lot of my upbringing and teaching was in that Catholic Christian doctrine. Yeah. I still consider, you know, I still am a Christian, even though I'm more of like a Methodist now, but. So, but all that said, I don't have a degree in Bible, but I do have a degree in religion, which sounds just as general. when I was an undergrad, I guess I really just kind of focused on whatever I wanted to focus on and took the classes that I thought were cool. And took some really good Christian theology ones, but also, you know, some other comparative religions. So I really like, I enjoy the story. It is very, very similar to the foundational Christian myth, but I also, John and I, also had some conversations off mic about the other religions in Temerant. And that I like thinking about that and wondering about, you know, we hear about Ventic superstition. We hear about, you know, who's more religious and all that. But we don't really hear about other religions. We just kind of get hints. So that's kind of been fascinating to me. But yeah, let's talk about the story of Talus in Nkanu. Wow. I almost said that. Let me take a little drink of water. Talu and Incanus. Yeah. So let's talk about, Talu and Menda. I mean, that's, and then the wife or the woman. I mean, that right there. Pariel. I mean, that's like textbook.
Yeah, it really is. Like, it's a really clear Mary analog. You know, that she was a God-fearing woman who found favor with God. And it's interesting. Like, I really like the things that Trappist's story bring out about Pariel, and the way that she was so charitable to her neighbors who were awful people. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of more of a Catholic thing, the way that she sort of intercedes on their behalf also to Menda later on when he has like miraculously grown into a man over the course of just a few days, and they come and like, basically it's like a, you know, sort of an angry mob with their torches and pitchforks and everything. And he's like, you know, I'm going to, you know, scourge this place of all of these people because they're dreadful, and she you know, sort of stands in the gap for them and says, like, how could you expect them to be better when the world is so full of things that, like, you know, make them hard, you know?
I will say the way that makes me think of Bendu from Star Wars, Bendu. A huge difference. So Telu as God does seem to be a tough, you know, a tough God, like the Christian and Jewish God and Muslim God of the Old Testament books, right? Because mm-hmm. it is all this. He's the same God for all of us, and you know, some sort other faiths
yeah.
too.
That's yeah, a whole I mean, other, that's sort of that's a really a whole other conversation. But yes,
that is all. But anyway, so the God of the Bible and the Torah is pretty vengeful in the beginning, right?
And so kind of
well,
yeah, but like, but mainly when that happens, like, so actually I'm on a Bible reading plan that's like super aggressive right now, and I'm getting through the entire Bible in 4 months, and so I'm Woof. Like I'm like
how many
deep
books
in the well, there's 66 books in the Bible. It basically averages out to about a half hour of reading every day.
That's not terrible.
It's not terrible. But anyway, you know, the fire and brimstone and like the pictures of the vengeful Old Testament God come when things have been going bad for a long time. You know,
sure.
And it's against people groups that like have been doing like genuinely horrific things
right.
for a long time. Like that's part of the reason in the story, at least, like you have the Israelites, you know, staying as slaves in Egypt for like 400 years. And part of the reason that that's happening and they weren't able to go like into the land that God promised to Abraham was because it says in the text, like, because the sin of the, which group is it? Of like one of these like Canaanite tribes is not yet complete. Like mm-hmm. there was still like this, you know, this forbearance and this mercy, because like, it wasn't as bad as it needed to be, essentially, for, you know, for to like engage brimstone mode.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so like, so yeah, there is like in the Old Testament, you do see like this like retribution and like this judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not capricious, and it's not like just straight up vengeful, and
it's tempered,
it's not arbitrary at all, and it is in the context of the rest of the, you know, the rest of the story, where like, and you see it with Israel, you know, and especially like in the book of Judges, like, you know, the Israelites turn away from God and like start worshiping the other gods that are there amongst the peoples in the Canaan, mm-hmm. here in the Promised Land. And then things go bad for them because like God withdraws his blessing, and then they're taken over by one of these other people groups. And then they cry out to God, and then he delivers them, you know, through a judge that he raises up. Mm-hmm. And like this happens mm-hmm. over and over and over and over and over again, like so many times. And so like, yes, there are like consequences when there's like straying from what God wants them to do. But like more than that, there's like mercy and grace and forgiveness when they turn back to him.
So it's not
just that like, oh, the Old Testament God is like vengeful and like genocidal and all of this stuff. Like there are consequences for sin, but the primary character of God that is consistent throughout the Old and the New Testaments is a willingness to show mercy and grace when there is repentance.
And so and thank you, because that I think that ties great into how I'm trying to connect that with Telu, because I'm thinking that Telu, the God, and Telu the man are seem to have sort of a same personality, where I was I don't know. Would you think of God?
Okay. Yeah. So the picture that we get in Trappist's story, and the way that Teilhu works in there is definitely distinct from how Christians think about God and his relationship with Jesus and the Holy mm-hmm. Spirit, and like talking and about the Trinity
relationship with us. Right.
Right. And so talking about the Trinity as a whole is probably outside the scope of the conversation that we want to have here. Although mm-hmm. it is St. Patrick's Day. And,
it is St. Patrick's Day tomorrow.
And I need you, please, I'm going to send you a link to a really, really hilarious little cartoon that you can put in the show notes that is about St. Patrick talking about the Trinity and trying to explain it to a couple of dense Irish farmers.
Oh, boy.
It's hilarious, and it's the best way that I love to celebrate St. Patrick's Day. Anyway.
The best way I love is watching the video of the people in, I forget where it was, who thought they saw the leprechaun on the tree in that one community. and everyone.
I don't know that one.
Oh, man. It was, it might have been down in Alabama, and it was viral maybe 15, 20 years ago. Of these people thought that they saw a leprechaun in a tree. It was just really good stuff.
So anyway, the way that Teilhu and Menda interact in the story that Trappist tells us is different than how Christians think about the way that God and Jesus are related to each other. Because in the story mm-hmm. of in Trappist's story, it literally is just Teilhu becoming Menda, and then he says, like, you think my name is Menda, actually I'm Teilhu. That would be a way of thinking about it that is called in like our theological parlance, Unitarianism, that there is mm-hmm. there's just one God, and he is expressed in different ways. That first you have God the Father, who becomes God the Son, who then becomes the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we would talk about that. But
it's interesting. I don't know if there's too much we can read here, but I'm on page 167 of the 10th anniversary. The Smith, Rengen is questioning, Menda, and he has coal black hair and eyes. And I think it's, what's interesting is he says, I am Periel's son, but I am not Menda. So he is, I mean, she did mm-hmm. give birth only in three months,
right?
3 months after the dream, she gives birth. So it mm-hmm. doesn't seem like, you know, because she tells him, I think you know very little about what it is to be a man, and I would still help them if I could. So right. you shall, Teilhu told her. And that's right. Mm-hmm. And so that accomplishes both things. She's going to help mankind by giving birth to, I guess, you know, let Teilhu be a man, or, you know, live as a man. Yes. So he knows what it's like. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And that was, I mean, you know, but God so loved the world that he sent his only
right.
son. I mean,
right, right. And
it's
so
not
the idea,
quite, I don't know if
go
it,
ahead.
It kind of is the same though. It kind of ends up the same, right?
It's very, very similar.
Kind of ends up the same.
And the, so in Christian theology, what we would say is that it's not so much that Jesus came to know what it's like, but that he mm-hmm. came in order to live a perfect life as a man, so then he would be able to become the perfect sacrifice for all of mankind's sins.
Mm.
Because the sin of mankind is against an infinite God, and so it requires an infinite sacrifice.
Sure.
And so, that... But then there's also, of course, the what we would call the vicarious, you know, nature of Christ's life also. And the book of Hebrews says, you know, that we don't have a high priest who is not able to be sympathetic for us. Like, Jesus does know what it is like to live in the world and to be subject to all the frailties of human nature and all that
stuff. And the emotions, right?
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Jesus really, you know, felt some strong emotions and, you know, had doubt, right? And had, you know, cried and laughed, you know, got sad when his friend died. I mean, that kind of,
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
I love the, I love the part here where, you know, where Rengen decides he's the first one to, to cross over to Teilu's side, and that he is struck down, you know, that there is still like this, there's this sense of like, you know, there are still consequences for the things that he has done wrong in his life. But then it says that he knelt down and like spoke to him softly and took away a lot of the pain of that scourging, you know, or that scouring. And, and that he did that for all of the people who would cross over to him. You know, and that's, you know, that, that's very resonant, you know, with how we think about, the way that there are still going to be consequences in our lives for, you know, things that we've done wrong, but that it's, but that there's comfort in knowing that those sins are forgiven. And so I can kind of, Sorry, go ahead.
So, yeah, and a lot of, well, it's interesting, you know, I want to, I just want to touch on, you know, when they crossed and Teilu knelt and spoke to them, giving them new names and healing some of their hurt. That's pretty cool too.
You know, one of the coolest things, this is one of the things that I love most in the Book of Revelation, is that it talks about... It talks
what a wild
about,
trip that one is.
Dude, Revelation is weird. But one of the coolest things that I love in Revelation is that it talks about each of the people who are in the Book of Life having a white stone with their own secret name that only God knows.
Yeah, I do remember that. I love that. Well, and the also... The well, no, I was gonna start talking about T.S. Eliot's The Naming of Cats, but but I'm trying and I'm flipping through. I'm kind of vamping here because I'm kind of there must be parallels between this story with people crossing to the path, and then when Scarpy is talking about, you know, when the angels are crowned, I guess.
Yeah,
and that's, but that's when they. And that's when you get this whole other thing, and I'm on page now, flip right of 198 when, when, you know, not all the Ruach go with Teilu. You know, Seletos. So there, this is such an interesting party here too, you know, chapter 20, whatever, Teilu's watchful eye. You have, here's this is all who's in the room. Okay, you got Seletos, Aleph, got all the Ruach, you got Teilu. Yeah. So like, this is the story, this is the story Scarpy gets kicked out for, is so Seletos forms the Amir.
Yeah.
And then Teilu says, you know, I hold justice foremost in my heart. I will leave this world behind that I might better serve it, serving you, you being Aleph. And that's when Teilu and the angels come forward and Aleph touches them. And that's when they become these, like, you know, the fire danced along their wings and they became swift. The fire flickered in their eyes and they saw into the deepest hearts of men. The fire filled their mouths and they sang songs of power, on and on and on. None but the most powerful can see them, and only then, with great difficulty and at great peril, like Quoth when he was about to die, they mete out justice to the world, and Teilu is the greatest of them all. So in this story, I think, you know, it, I guess it's not possible that, that Teilu is the one deity, if we're taking the story into account, because there's a lot of power here, right. You know, Aleph, like we were talking about before, according to Quoth and according to probably Scarpy, is like the big cheese, but yeah. The Talon religion is like, no, it's this dude Teilu. Here's our story. And you know, that it just, I mean, you know, the Talon church seems to, I guess, you know, have be strong enough in the Commonwealth. So this was a risk for Scarpy to tell. Right. Because, you know, all these Talons and Commonwealth people don't necessarily want to hear that, like, hey man, your God's nothing special.
Right.
I mean, no, nobody
wants to hear that.
And I, you know, I've heard that because I know that, you know, we as Christians know that to our Jewish and Muslim friends, you know, Jesus was a prophet. All right. He was, you know, yeah. He had some stuff to say. He might've been a servant of God, but he wasn't everything you guys thought he was.
Yeah.
You know, that's a little similar to this.
You know, the interesting thing, and I've actually heard this from Jewish people, the interesting thing that a lot of like religious Jewish people think about Jesus is that he was the Messiah for the Gentiles. That it's good and right for the Gentiles to have Jesus.
For us? Meaning
yeah.
us?
Yeah. Yeah, sorry, non-Jews, Gentiles. Right. Gentiles meaning anyone who's not Jewish.
Yeah.
That it's good and right for us to have Jesus. Like, he is, like, our way to God, since we aren't, like, Jewish.
Oh, so, like, we have,
but
like...
But they don't need him. And their Messiah... Their Messiah who will come and, like, really, like, restore Israel to its like proper place is still coming.
Right.
Yeah.
And then so I want to make sure, so we got a little caught up in Scarpy's story as well as Trappist's story. And they are, especially in the 10th anniversary edition, when these are big, big pages, they are not very far apart in the book.
Yeah.
So what you know, what else? You mentioned, you know, when we're talking about Teilu and Incan, you know, Teilu pursuing Incanus in this fight.
Yes.
You know, what do we make of this? I think we can tie it to stories we know. But this is just like, this almost reminds me of certain things remind me more of Greek mythology really than anything we really would see in the Bible. We don't see a ton of this mythology in the Bible, I don't think, except for Revelations, where seven is a significant number, except maybe in some other books I'm forgetting.
There's like numbers are really significant all throughout the Bible. Like there's a lot of like numerical significance in a lot of the different parts of the Bible. But with the seven cities, you mean?
And there's all sorts of sevens in Revelation, I thought.
There but are many, I mean, many sevens in Revelation, yes. There are the seven churches that all get letters at the beginning of Revelation. There are three different sets of seven judgments that fall on the world throughout the course of the book. There's lots of sevens in Revelation.
There are, but it makes a point. A Trappist's story makes a point. First it says Teilu chases Incanus for 7 years, and then we have this... you know, this kind of last run where Incanus flees for 7 days, and then Teilu drew near before Incanus could bring his power to bear, and the seventh city was saved. That is why seven is a lucky number and why we celebrate on Cheyenne. The seventh city was saved. Oh, but no, but the chase continues into days 8, 9, and 10, actually.
Right.
It's not a seven-day thing. But there are, I thought there was maybe some other sevens in the Trappist story, but I guess not. There's just, at the end of 7 years, Tailu's feet had carried him all through the world. So that's where he spent 7 years driving out the demons.
Uh-huh.
So that's why I found 1-7, I think. And because, Canis and Tailu don't like really die together until it appears like the 10th day or almost the 11th day. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds right.
Yep.
So let's talk about that scene for a second, because like that also is like highly resonant with like the sacrifice of Jesus, right? That like, it's in the Bible, of course, it's not a literal like battle with
the devil,
with Satan. But it metaphorically very, very much is, and it's frequently depicted in like different sorts of religious art, as that battle. But you know, the sacrifice is sort of the primary thing. What I think is so interesting is like in this story, you know, he actually, Tailu himself makes forges the wheel.
Yeah.
You know, that he binds. Yeah. With the help of all sorts of other, you know, people who are around, like that's pretty cool. It's interesting the way that like somehow Incanus is able to break free from those chains and necessitates
Tailu has to
jumping down in there to hold him on the wheel as they both burn. Like that's pretty intense.
So it's so intense, and I want to pull back a little bit and a lot of what I do on this podcast sometimes is be like, oh, who could make similarities like we've been doing. But my point is that I see some similarities in how Incanus speaks and how Cathaya speaks.
Say more.
Some of these... And maybe a touch of Celatos. So I'm just going to read.
I love that, because my theory is that Celatos is the Cathaya.
And many people have said it, and many people are saying it.
Mm. Yeah.
But
like, you're right. And something that is mentioned there. Sorry, real quick. I'm just going to say that it talks about the Cathaya or the it talks about Incanus, whose voice is like a knife in the minds of men. And like that to me, that like resonates so strongly with the nature of the Cathaya as well.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, go ahead.
I told you to speak no lie, Incanus, Tailu said piteous. My path then, Incanus shrieked. I do not regret. Mm-hmm. If I had my choice again, I would only change how fast I ran. Your people are like cattle my kind feed on. Bite and break you. That's the part I think is Cathay-ish. Because of when it says blood, bracken, and bone. That just reminds me that bite and break you.
Okay.
And just the fact that Tailu, it seems like Tailu like orders it not to tell lies. And we know Cathaya doesn't tell lies. So that makes me think of there... that. And just
is there an element of truth in this story that like speaks to the nature of the Cathaya? Like maybe it's bound in the tree because it is like, maybe that is what's left over, you know, mm-hmm. from this fight with Tailu. It's going to be so cool. Like, I know like people have been saying this stuff for, you know, for a dozen years now, but like, it's going to be so cool when we have the full story to like look back on all of these things and see how all of these threads are like weaving together and like what's truth from here and like how does it all come together? Because it's going to be sweet.
Oh, and there's, I also forgot a couple paragraphs before Bite and Break You, and Canis also says, rack and shatter you, what do you want of me?
Uh-huh.
So Cathaya. So as we, let's pull out a little bit from all of our religious dissecting, because I want to talk about just religion and Temerant in general, but I also kind of want to talk about what Quoth's religion seems, or like religious views seem to be, and just kind of what the view is in general of the Talon yeah. religion. Do we get any indication, you know, what Quoth's parents, you know, believe? Does he say anything about that?
He does mention that they didn't feel the need to solemnize their marriage in front of any sort of religious authority. I get the sense that they are very much kind of the just sort of like that they're too practical for it. They're just kind of agnostic mostly.
Sure.
And mostly the sense that we get from Quoth towards religion, as far as I, you know, my sense of it at least, is sort of like a general dismissiveness.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, oh, people have these beliefs, but the reality of the world is, you know, X, Y, Z. There are no demons. There are only the Fae. You know, he doesn't seem to have a lot of use for religion in general.
Well, even, you know, even young Quoth is able to recognize when a certain town is gonna want a play, you know, with lessons from the Book of the Path on it,
right?
All in it. You know, he kind of understands that religion is something some people hold very, you know, very close to him, and or very close to them, and for his purposes it can be used, you know, to play your crowd. But you know, I think what a week it's been. Two quotes stick out to me when I'm thinking about Quoth's religion. The first is Coat saying, only priests and fools are fearless, and I've never been on the best of terms with God, or something like that. That tells you something. And then someone asks teenage Quoth, I forget who it is, if he's religious or if he believes in God. And he says, Talu, after a fashion, which is kind of like, sounds like something someone who is maybe agnostic might say, is like,
yeah,
I mean, there's something up there, or like, yeah, I guess yeah. so. So, but, it, you know, he certainly, I'll say a Noir, he certainly seems to have a certain opinion about one local priest, Abbe yeah. Leoden. That's an interesting spelling for a name, isn't it?
A little bit. So there's Abbe Leoden, but there's also Abbe Grimes.
Who, Quoth says, do you remember?
I looked it up. He said he's a decent sort
for a priest. But right. Abbe Leoden in the American version, and probably the UK version, is an anagram of Elodin. Leoden is an anagram of Elodin.
Interesting. So
that has been seized upon. But yeah, it seems, and even, you know, young Quoth also in Tarbian will get bread from the priests if they you know, if they don't ask him to get too close. And right. I do not really like thinking about what that implies.
Boy,
I think we can all yeah. let our imaginations go, and you and me probably don't really need to cover that. But,
no,
you know,
that's a topic for happens, a different podcast.
You know what? It is atrocious, and it happens everywhere, and it happens now. And it happened then, and it unfortunately is going to happen tomorrow.
Yeah.
So, I also, I just want to make sure we note that, like, the church is also very involved with the law, because at least in the Commonwealth, because as Kvothe tells us, you know, they put him through the church courts, and the church has all this records of the time he went to court.
Right.
And that's interesting, but it's not like that everywhere, right? This seems to be a Commonwealth Aetor thing. Are Aetorans very religious, or is this like a Commonwealth thing? What do you make of
that? The Aeturian Empire, or Aetor right now, is what's left over from the Aeturian Empire, which was very much the tail end. It was sort of Rome, really, was the Aeturian Empire. So
sure,
the tail end religion is definitely England. Strongly related. Okay, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, so do we know about, so let's think, Sim is probably Talyn. Do we know anything about Will or anything about any of Quoth's other friends?
So Will is a Shald, and he mentions that, like, the religion of the Talyns is, like, quaint. He sort of has this sort of very superior kind of, like, very, you know, enlightened in his own mind, like, outlook on it. And I can't remember exactly where that comes out, but it's kind of just a passing comment that he makes about how,
Will believes in the Fae. I mean, those comments he makes when they're drunk, and then the fact that he has no trouble believing Falurian. Like, I think Will is probably, you know, polytheistic, or, you know, the Shaldish people don't really have any, you know, anything to be afraid of, with the Fae. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I didn't really have anything else to.
Got a dry.
To say that.
Ooh, I got a dry throat. Well, now there are a couple we get hints of polytheism in a couple comments people make about more than one god, right? Fella says tiny gods. I believe right. Savoy says tiny gods, and a couple other people. Count Threat. But I want to make sure that we mention there is the Pat's Tale of Laniel Young again, which I don't really know much about, but I have seen parts of the prologue where the Modagans are said to have a tall god who is strong and tall and white and wise. But then there's also some old art, apparently, for like a card deck that's called Gods in the Hollow. And it's apparently supposed to be Modagan gods. So between that and some of the comments, I think that they're polytheistic. But then you've also got Yil and the Small Kingdoms.
Yeah.
You've got the Adem, who, like we've talked about, have the Lethani. You've got Vintish people, I believe, are...
Vintish? The Vint have, like, the superstitions. Right, exactly.
And Brayden apparently has his pagan rituals, whatever the hell those are. Yeah.
That's 100%. Like, whatever he's doing with the Chandrian.
Oh, Brayden's. I think Brayden says tiny gods, not Threp. Brayden. And that, of course, makes sense.
Yeah.
Says tiny
but
gods.
But no, Brayden is a, like, that's not just a throwaway thing. He's really doing something, like, dark and nasty, because he's in cahoots with with whoever the bad people are, because it may, because of course, like, you know, it's gonna come out at the end of this that Kvothe was on the wrong end of this huge cosmic war of good and evil, and the sides and who is good and who is bad are gonna end up being a lot more complicated than we thought.
I don't know. We'll see.
Oh, are you not sold on that?
Not sold on. I am. I kind of am. I don't really know if, like, it's, you know, like, the Chandrian were actually good, you know, working for the good all along level of, like, you know, you were talking earlier about how this story is not what we expect. I don't know right. if it's, like, that level where you know, that turns everything on its head, but, like, there's definitely, I mean, it's definitely not as easy as it, not as, you know, straightforward as it appears.
Yeah.
But, like, I think I'm some 100% things that are somewhat straightforward.
I'm 100% on team, the Chandrian did not actually kill Kvothe's troop. And
I don't know.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. I don't know. Then who did?
The Emir, probably. I'm not sure. I don't know how it's all going to work out, but I'm pretty sure in the end of it, we're going to find out the Chandrian are not actually the villains.
I mean, they don't really seem like the type to do a lot of that sword work, but they do. I mean, but then again, Cinder was traveling with those bandits, so it's just like, you know, they're just piloting around their little
It doesn't mean they're good, you know? Like, it doesn't mean that the Chandrian are actually good, but, like, what I think that the evidence for them having killed Kvothe's troop is circumstantial, except that what the Cathaya tells him, that's definitely something that pokes some holes in it. But I
can't even start thinking of that levels. I mean, I've thought of some. I mean, I will entertain that Scarpy story about Lanrei isn't true. I can accept that, like, there's something wrong there, you know, that Scarpy doesn't know and that Dennis, you know, maybe Dennis' song is right.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm willing to accept that. But I don't know about...
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, I don't know about yours.
All right. So let's kind of focus back in here, because there's one other thing that we need to get to before we finish up. And that is the origin of Trappist.
I know. You clued me in about this.
This is so cool. Yeah. We'll link to this article on Pat's blog where he talks about this, this, like, humanitarian work that his mom did in Haiti, and this barefoot dude who would take care of all of the, like, the starving kids that he could find. Mm-hmm. And that he thought that this was at one point a Trappist monk. Da-da, and this was very much the sort of the prototype for the character of Trappist.
And this is a 2015 blog post from Pat that I'll try to remember to link in the show notes. When I go back to edit this, I'm just, like, having fun talking to my buddy John right now and, like, giving future me so much work. You know, we both are, because we're both like, RJ, put this in here. RJ, I'm going to put this in.
RJ is going to be so mad at us.
I know. I'm going to be editing this in, like, 2 or 3 months when I bring myself out of my grief hiatus. And I'm going to be like, what the hell, man? Like, you should have put this in the document. So I'm really glad, you know, we didn't really touch on any theories, but one, it's late, this has gone long, and I'm sure there are crackpot theories about Trappist being, you know, secretly being Baron Greyfallow, you know, cause, or, like, secretly being Cinder or whatever. And there's more but, you know, we just can't.
Sorry, Trappist is a tinker.
He's mending the world. I like that.
A little bit at a time by caring for children.
A mender, the mender heresies.
Well, that's a whole other thing. Yeah, that we
is
just
a whole
do
other
not
thing.
have time for now.
We don't have, but I mean, I think, you know, Quoth's theory is correct. You know, I think, you know, if we maybe should ask this off the top, but like, what do you think Trappist's story is? You know, I think he probably, you know, got fed up with corruption in the church and started taking care of kids, you know, in Teilhu's name. Or,
and
you
this
know,
is, this is something that
thing.
We mentioned off mic beforehand that I do want to point out that like this, like, cause I actually know people who have fostered and adopted kids with like severe developmental and mental handicaps. And this is something that you just don't see people doing unless they're operating out of like a deep faith and conviction. And that resonates so, so true, you know, for Trappist. I think it's exactly what you said. Like he got,
you mean like out of the, you know, people don't like people who are caretakers for children with disabilities, you're saying like really have to, you know, have to like have a belief in it and like,
I
think
even,
that, yeah,
and
Trappist is doing this because he needs to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause he is called to do it for sure. I really do think it was a matter of like, it could have been that was his temple and it burned down around him. Right.
Oh, but, interesting.
I just thought of that, you know, but I think it was just a matter of like, he just doesn't take care of himself. And like, he went down there one day and started taking care of kids and really hasn't come up since, you know?
Yeah.
Just slapping around there in his bare feet. Poor guy. I mean, those feet have to be nasty in the damp all the time, like slapping around his toe. How fucked up do you think his toenail? How fucked up are Trappist's toenails?
I don't know.
Like, that's when I know we have to end.
No. The book doesn't tell us that they're gross. It just tells us that they're
gnarly.
Bad. So that's what I'm. That's what I'm kind of. I'm gonna stick on that. On that one.
Oh man.
I would prefer for him not to have like fungal infested feet. That's just.
Yeah, maybe
I don't like it.
I should have stuck with diabetes. Also, maybe a final note. There is Quoth mentions just real quick when he first sees Trappist, the Duke of Gibeah, because he's like afraid that this is a Duke of Gibeah like situation. And that, of course, you know, that you never freaking realize is mentioned, you know, your first time reading, you're like, who? And then, you know, a book and a half later, you know, Quoth and Simon bring it up. So
like, that's just, and we can close with this. Like, that is just like one example of how perfectly Pat Rothfuss is in control of this material. Like all of these things are sprinkled in and woven all the way through. And it's
that's why the third one's taken so long.
It's a masterpiece. Like, there's nothing else to say about it.
I mean, oh my God. God love you, Pat. From what it sounds like, he wrote these books the same way I'd do it. And if this, Pat, I can be as frustrated with you as I want, but at the end of the day, you are hashtag just like me. I would be doing this same shit probably.
Yeah, I have no patience for anyone who complains about how long book three is taking, because it's going to take as long as it's going to take and it will be perfect.
I do complain, but I'll say now, it might have been you that pointed it out. My moving targeted date for book three is now not before 2025. I almost have a good, I want to say I have a good feeling about 2025, 2026. I want to say I have a good feeling about it. My last prediction was true, although it wasn't a hard prediction. And that prediction was we wouldn't get it before 2023. Now, if it comes out in the next 9 months,
it's definitely
however many months,
well, you never don't
know.
Worry about it.
You because, never like, know.
Because by the time he gets around to actually announcing it, like that's still going to be a year out before the release date.
Well, someone, and hey, thank you. I got to say a quick thank you to Kevin for donating to me on Ko-Fi. Thank you so much, man.
Good job, Kevin.
Really late. Thank you. Yeah, thanks, dude. I really appreciate you. But all that to say that if I'm right and the book comes out in, you know, 2025 or 2026, which is such a soft guess, but y'all have to pay me money. all right. John, this was so wonderful. Thank you so much. And
yeah, I'm glad we did it. I also have my own show called Two Geek Soup, we look at geek culture from a Christian perspective. And so if you thought it was interesting to hear me talk on and on about theology here, then you can hear me do the same thing and apply it to like the Marvel movies or The Handmaid's Tale. Boy, was that rough. I didn't enjoy that.
I'm sure, but it was.
Anyway, Two Geek Soup. It's been on hiatus for a while, but I do have new episodes that I have already recorded, and sweet, I also just have to like get myself up to do the editing and posting of them. But it's fun. I love it. Yep.
Awesome, dude. Yeah, we'll plug that, and then this will live on my computer for a while, but
maybe I'll have new episodes of my show before this actually comes out.
I'm going to be coming in here slicing. This episode is going to be an absolute mess. I can't wait. Yeah. Thank you so much again.
Yeah.
Trappist, a real one. And two, all you listeners near and far, may all your stories be glad ones and your roads be smooth and short. Bye.